This is Reaction. Movements, moments, and monsters of the reactionary right. The John Birch Society, Part 1. A Man on a Mission. On October 4th, 2023, at 2:20 p.m., the United States government issued a test of its emergency alert system. Conducted by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, it was supposed to ensure that the existing infrastructure for national emergency alerts was functioning. Every radio, television, and cell phone in the United States signaled a loud and very annoying alarm, accompanied by a message stating that it was just a test. Innocuous enough, right? I mean, it was going to last for 30 whole minutes, pretty disruptive if you ask me. Except it didn't, and you could dismiss the alarm immediately. And then there's the fact that Russia tested its own system the very same day, a sign that hostilities between the two nations were about to spill over beyond the borders of the war in Ukraine. Except they didn't. It was going to destroy all appliances and electronic devices. Or maybe it would finally activate the 5G, or the nanobots in the vaccine, or the highly dangerous Marburg virus. It would turn the vaccinated into zombies. Maybe it would kill them. It would switch on an army of Antifa super soldiers who would attack citizens in the streets. These were the theories circulated on platforms like Twitter, Facebook, and Telegram, as well as countless family group chats. I even saw an exchange between a landlord and their tenant that they would be cutting electricity to the apartment for the day to protect their appliances. They recommended the tenant turn off their cell phone and wrap it in tinfoil. Obviously, none of it came to pass. But that's because the Patriots were onto them. Them? You know who they are. Democrats, communists, Jews, the Illuminati, the Bilderberger Group. It depends on who you ask, but the them serves the same purpose for everyone who obsesses over Manichaean battles between good and evil. It helps make sense of the world. It gives order to chaos. It makes you feel smarter than your adversaries who are infected with the woke mind virus. And it grounds all of your fears and uncertainties and confusion in reality, even if that reality is one of your own making. Obama is in league with Satan. Trump is a victim of the greatest witch hunt of all time. The chemicals are turning the frogs gay. I don't mean to be flippant. It's easy to lose sight of the fact that these are real beliefs held by real people, and there are no simple explanations. It's much more complicated than an aggrieved white working class or an exploitative capitalist system that robs us of dignity. It's not simply a subpar education system or a media industrial complex that rakes in profits by making us fearful. These things are just part of the equation. There's something deeper, almost mystical to conspiracy theory, to the pattern-seeking apophenia that drives our perception of the world. It goes back to the Greeks, the gods conspiring against you personally by destroying your crops. Better make a sacrifice. It goes back to the earliest trickster gods, to the very forces of rain and drought and locusts and plague. Misfortune comes from somewhere. Humans have put a lot of energy into figuring out the source. In his pamphlet, A Summary View of the Rights of British America, Thomas Jefferson wrote, "Single acts of tyranny may be ascribed to the accidental opinion of a day, but a series of oppressions, begun at a distinguished period and pursued unalterably through every change of ministers, too plainly prove a deliberate, systematical plan of reducing us to slavery." We don't tend to think of our founding fathers as conspiracy theorists, but this statement could have easily been written in modern parlance by any believer in QAnon or Stop the Steal. The difference is a matter of legitimacy, whether or not you can get the public to sign on. Whether or not you can get yourself recognized by the political establishment or manage to get the powers that be to finally admit, "All right, you got us." MKUltra was a conspiracy theory until it wasn't. Big Tobacco knew cigarettes caused cancer. The Gulf of Tonkin attack was faked and the Tuskegee experiment was real. I'm not suggesting that the 2020 election was stolen or that the storm is coming, just that conspiracy is more complex than it seems. Its relationship to power has more bearing on its perceived truth than the content of its thought. It's not about being right, it's about being validated. And by whom? In January of 1945, municipal workers in Grand Rapids, Michigan, began a little experiment. They dissolved powdered sodium fluoride into the public water supply. It was the New Deal era, and Michigan had just helped deliver FDR his third term. Trust in government was high. So when rates of children's tooth decay plummeted in Grand Rapids, nearby Muskegon, Michigan demanded their water be fluoridated too. As of 2020, 72% of the U.S. population has access to public fluoridated water. But in the last 10 years, dozens of cities have voted to remove fluoride from their water supply. In 2022, a municipal water treatment center's superintendent in Richmond, Vermont, went rogue and decreased the city's fluoride levels himself. He was concerned because the fluoride came from China. 80 years of experimentation shows that in low doses, fluoride is perfectly safe to drink and reduces tooth decay by 25%. But some see a more nefarious rationale behind the government's fluoridation efforts. It's poison. It causes cancer. It diminishes intelligence and birth rates. It's used for communist mind control. So say members of the John Birch Society. Once a potent force in American politics, today the JBS has little influence outside of very fringe issues such as fluoridation or returning to the gold standard. Nonetheless, the Birchers cast a long shadow on the history of U.S. politics, and their legacy is still felt today. The John Birch Society was, first and foremost, a rabidly anti-communist organization focused on public education and advocacy, spreading the gospel that an international cabal of left-wing elites had reached its tendrils into the very fabric of American politics and society. The media, the government, the education system, and every other institution that shapes American life has been infiltrated by communist extremists bent on building a one-world order and enslaving all peoples everywhere. President Dwight D. Eisenhower himself, the man who had saved the West from fascism and was a war hero in his own right, was at the very center of the conspiracy. Even the military had been corrupted. With a peak membership of, according to some sources, 100,000 in 1965 and 66, the Birchers managed to have an outsized impact on American political discourse thanks to their ability to mobilize members on specific issues of the day. Energized by the highly contentious 1964 nomination and subsequent loss of Barry Goldwater, the JBS had something to say about every controversial issue of the era: the civil rights movement, the Vietnam War, the assassination of President Kennedy, the Cuban Missile Crisis, and beyond. In January of 1965, a full 79% of voting-age Americans were aware of the JBS, putting them on par with the American Communist Party and the NAACP. But who exactly was John Birch? Even if you know the name of the society, it's less likely you know anything about its namesake. He's no Joseph McCarthy. His only claim to fame is being picked out of obscurity by the society's leader, Robert Welch. An Air Force intelligence captain and OSS field agent in China during World War II, John Birch worked closely with both Chinese communists and nationalists on the Eastern Front. He was born in British colonial India in 1918 while his Presbyterian missionary parents were stationed in the Himalayas. When his father contracted malaria in 1920, the family returned to the United States and left the Presbyterian Church for the fundamentalist Baptist tradition. A bright student, John graduated high school and college at the top of his class. His senior year of college at Mercer University, he joined a group of students fighting the school's perceived liberal ideology, particularly around the teaching of evolution. The group was extremely unpopular on campus, and he later said he regretted the crusade. Birch's fellow students saw him as a radical. One classmate said, "He was always an angry young man, always a zealot. He felt he was called to defend the faith, and he alone knew what it was. A psychology professor said of him, he was like a one-way valve, everything coming out and no room to take anything in. This surety reared its head at a tender age. By 11, John knew he wanted to become a Baptist missionary. After graduating from Mercer, he attended the J. Frank Norris Fundamental Baptist Bible Institute in Fort Worth, Texas. He completed the two-year program in just 1 year, graduating again at the top of his class. Birch was eager to follow Norris's example and proselytize in China, fully aware of the dangers he faced. He told his family upon leaving, "Goodbye, folks. If we don't meet again on earth, we'll meet in heaven." Birch arrived in Japanese-controlled Shanghai in 1940, in the middle of the Second Sino-Japanese War, moving to Hangzhou a few months later. The country was in shambles, war-torn, with coastal areas under Japanese administration and refugees fleeing inland. After a few months, he embarked on a dangerous journey on foot, arriving in an impoverished and isolated area in inland China to run a mission station. Struck with malaria and dengue fever and living on a thin diet of rice and vegetables, his health deteriorated. But his Mandarin skills were sophisticated enough for him to sermon to the locals in villages and towns where Chinese guerrillas fought Japanese troops. He claimed to have cured a young child of fever, exorcised a demon from a woman, and forced a Japanese officer to open the gate to the city of Hangzhou, all with the power of prayer. In November of 1941, Birch again crossed Japanese lines to return to Shanghai and take a language exam. He stayed for a few weeks before crossing back to inland China, and just in time, December 5th. The following day, the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor and launched a massive internment effort in the Chinese regions they held. Had Birch not made it out, he likely would have been interned as well. The Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor brought a more patriotic register to Birch's missionary work, and combined with his frustrations with the bureaucracy of his mission bosses, he started to become disenchanted with organized religion. He increasingly thought the army was a superior way to preach the gospel, not least because the army actually fed its troops. As luck would have it, in April of 1942, he happened upon Lieutenant Jimmy Doolittle, who had just dropped into inland China after bombing Tokyo. Birch then wrote to the American military mission in China that he most wanted to be a chaplain, but would cheerfully carry a rifle or do whatever else he was told. He received a telegram from the army telling him to report to the nearest airbase, where he served as an interpreter for crews coming into the field. By July, Birch had been commissioned as a second lieutenant working as a field intelligence officer, thanks to his intimate knowledge of the country and its people. Birch operated with nationalist Chinese soldiers, creating intelligence networks and relaying information about Japanese troop movements and the shipping of goods to his army superiors. He rescued downed pilots in Japanese-controlled regions and continued to hold church services for Chinese Christians. Then, in 1945, Birch was transferred to the Office of Strategic Services and ordered to northern China to accept the surrender of Japanese commanders. The war had been won. Chinese communists took issue with this, seeing the U.S. as potentially another occupying force. But Birch had worked with both the nationalists and the communists throughout his time in China and wasn't particularly worried about hostilities breaking out. He was sent to Shandong province to gather intelligence on airfields. Once there, he traveled by foot and by train throughout the province and into Anhui, where they ran into the communist military. They demanded Birch disarm himself, but he refused. He was shot in the left thigh, then his ankles and wrists were bound, he was forced to kneel, and was again shot in the head. His body was then bayoneted and thrown into a ditch alongside his mission aide. The rest of his team were taken as prisoners. Birch was transported to a Chinese hospital where an autopsy revealed his cause of death. The aide who was thrown in a ditch with Birch miraculously survived to tell the tale. Birch and two of his dead comrades were given Catholic burial services and placed in crypts on the side of a mountain in China. It's a harrowing story, John Birch has been called one of the last casualties of World War II and the first of the Cold War. And he was the perfect figure for Robert Welch to use to build an empire. Had Robert Welch not plucked John Birch out of obscurity, it's almost certain you'd have never heard of him. One of the earliest American victims of communism, killed doing the heroic task of liberating the Chinese from Japanese occupation while spreading the message of Christianity, he was tailor-made for Welch's mission, the perfect anti-communist martyr. The story of the John Birch Society is very much the story of Robert Welch, and in order to understand his life's work, it's useful to take a look at the Welch family tree and Robert's lineage. His great-great-grandfather, Edward Welch, emigrated from Wales in the early 1700s, settling in Chewan County, North Carolina. He was a deeply religious man, a Baptist at a time when being a Baptist put a target on your back. A man of the Second Great Awakening, Edward felt that Enlightenment rationalism had taken over American churches and that a more emotional Christianity was the path to salvation. His brother David was the first pastor of Ballard's Bridge Church, where revivals drew large crowds to the new evangelism. Here, God's grace was not preordained, but up to the individual's free will and their decision to be born again. In America, under the Christian God, a man made his own way and his own destiny. The Welches were yeomen gentry, farmers at a time when farming was a highly desirable vocation in the South. They were slave owners, proud Democrats who loved President Jackson and supported the Confederacy in the Civil War. Chewan citizens were hostile to the Northern mercantile class, even speaking of an Eastern conspiracy of elites bent on stealing the great riches of the South. Edward's son, Willis, a fairly wealthy slave owner, lived the life of a courtly Southern gentleman. The 1831 Nat Turner slave insurrection took place just 70 miles away, and Chewan County was regularly under threat from runaway slaves. Slowly but surely, the Welch's way of life was bound for upheaval, and Willis's son William joined the Confederacy as a private in the first Civil War regiment raised in North Carolina. He was one of Chewan's Dixie Boys, and after the war he settled down in Chewan and had two sons, Robert Henry and William Dorsey. But with the family's primary source of wealth and status, slaves, now gone, life was quite different for the Welches and their neighbors. Chewan was in shambles. The population dropped, cotton fields were overtaken by thick weeds, farmers had difficulty finding seed, and their livestock grew thin. Inflation was rampant. Banks and storefronts closed. Education was nearly non-existent and roads fell into disrepair. The value of once grand antebellum estates was in freefall without slaves to do the hard labor and lots were sold off in chunks. Hatred for and fear of the Eastern elites grew. A cabal of international bankers conspired against hardworking Southerners. Reconstruction was not going well. But Robert and his brother William managed to do fairly well for themselves. Robert diversified his holdings, growing cotton and corn and raising hogs. By the late 1890s, things were improving for Southern farmers. Gold was coming in from South Africa and Brazil, and with more gold came more money in circulation. William went into politics with the Populists, or the People's Party, which grew out of the Farmers' Alliance. He served a term as a Democratic state representative, during which he supported a successful constitutional amendment stripping Black South Carolinians of the right to vote. Meanwhile, Robert had a baby boy. Robert Henry Winborn Welch Jr. was born on December 1, 1899, in the same county where his great-great-grandfather had settled. He grew up on a large plantation home called Stockton, one of the few such Monticello-style elaborate estates in the area to survive the Civil War. The family held tight to Southern values, routines, and attitudes, including reverence for their Confederate forebears and strict adherence to their Baptist faith. Robert Jr. was a sort of child prodigy. He could read by the age of 3, do multiplication tables at 4, and was studying Latin by age 7. Unlike his siblings, who had plenty of farm chores around the estate, Robert was always studying and had little of the responsibility of his brother and sisters. He was homeschooled by his mother until the age of 10, when he enrolled in high school as an advanced student. The closest high school was 10 miles away in Elizabeth City, and the Welches traveled by horse and buggy to drop Robert Jr. off at the Raleigh Hotel, where he lived alone Monday through Friday, traveling back to Stockton for the weekends. He entered as a 10-year-old junior. Just 2 years later, he was accepted into the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, the youngest student to ever enroll. Much like his idol John Birch, Robert was well known as a firebrand and an indomitable crusader for Christ, describing his own attempts to convert other students as insufferable. He was a member of the Tennis Association, the Philanthropic Literary Society, the YMCA, the Historical Society, and the Albemarle Club. He excelled in mathematics, German, French, literature, and had a special interest in Faust, Goethe, and poetry of all kinds. Robert never did one thing and did it well. He did a dozen things, and he did them all well. He had no love for philosophy, however, and called his professor's teachings intellectual aerobics and nihilistic indoctrination. Welch graduated from UNC at the age of 16 and attended North Carolina State University in Raleigh, working towards a master's degree, which he quickly lost interest in. He went on to the United States Naval Academy in 1917 with dreams of traveling the world, but he again found the curriculum unrewarding. There were no offerings in his favorite subjects, social sciences, economics, biology, or ethics. It was dull, and the regimentation didn't suit him either. He was, as described by Edward H. Miller in A Conspiratorial Life, Robert Welch, The John Birch Society, and the Revolution of American Conservatism, a young buck with a maverick streak. Despite earning excellent grades, he dropped out after 2 years and returned to Stockton, intent on following his true calling, becoming a writer. He began to write for the Norfolk Ledger, his headline jingles, weekly summaries of the news in verse form. He earned $2 per column, attacking President Wilson, the Democratic Party, and socialism. Here's a taste. "The plan to nationalize the roads we think is just plumb foolish. Although some brotherhoods may balk and act a wee bit mulish, the country as a whole is not inclined to socialism, and laziness and envy work in vain for communism." Not exactly Faust. His penchant for conspiracy and drawing dubious connections shone through in his headline jingles. Writing about the connection between income tax laws and labor strikes, he speculated, "The actors in Chicago and New York took to their legs about the time the government took some few million eggs. We wonder if the two events have any slightest connection. Our own experience on the stage has prompted that reflection." Headline jingles became syndicated in other local papers, and Robert was offered a full-time job with the Raleigh News and Observer, but he passed up the opportunity because he felt a career in journalism couldn't provide the financial security he sought. Meanwhile, his father, chagrined that he had passed up a lucrative career in the Navy, worried about his son's reluctance to commit to some career path. Money was important to Robert. He was now set on becoming a businessman, but he had no clue where to begin, eventually concluding that a law degree might be a good start. He began to attend Harvard Law School at the age of 19, where he met his future wife, Marion Probert, a student at Wellesley College. But Robert clashed with his mostly progressive professors, especially future liberal Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter. They spoke of using the legal system to improve society, which Robert thought a communistic folly. He was suspicious of the labor movement and boycotts. He supported restrictions on immigration and scoffed at the so-called hyphenism of American ethnic groups like German-American, African-American, and Italian-American. These ideological differences led to him dropping out of Harvard in 1922, just 1 year away from graduating. Welch had decided that neither the military nor legal fields were for him. Instead, he was going to make a fortune in the business world. But how? One night, Robert was writing in his journal when he asked himself a question. What is the surest and shortest road to financial success? More specifically, what goods in demand would be best for me to start manufacturing without either capital or experience? An associate of his later recounted, as the sky began to show the first streaks of dawn, Robert stared at the notes in front of him. One word remained amid the maze of dark lines scratched across the pages. The word was candy. So, the following day, he made his way to John G. Gale's Harvard Square candy shop, where he purchased their fudge recipe for $150. He rented a 1,500-square-foot loft with no heat, no water, and no electrical lighting. His soon-to-be fiancée, Marion, wrapped the fudge. The Oxford Candy Company was born. In 1920, Robert married Marion Probert. She was the only woman for him, and he was a devoted husband all his life. Marion had poise and sophistication. She was his intellectual equal and as socially conservative as he was. Robert believed women should be docile and subordinate, and Marion agreed. She loved literature, music, and history. She was his advisor in all things business and philosophy. He couldn't afford a ring, but Marion didn't care. She was as smitten as he. Their wedding day was Robert's first kiss, and he never kissed another as long as he lived. The very next day, they went back to mixing and wrapping fudge. But his early attempts at entrepreneurship didn't go well. Despite his doggedness, he worked up to 20 hours a day, his brother Edward's assistance, and some successes early on, the Oxford Candy Company struggled. The cash flow was often so tight that Robert had to pawn office supplies to pay his workers. He was constantly in debt. Things seemed to be turning around with his invention of the sugar daddy in 1926, and in 1927 the company saw record profits. Robert was on the path to becoming a millionaire. Then came the stock market crash of 1929, and Robert's debts caught up with him. Chocolate prices skyrocketed, and the Oxford Candy Company eventually went belly up in 1929 after the board of directors split over whether or not to reduce the quality of the candy they were producing. In the meantime, Robert had two sons, Robert Henry III and Hillard Welch. He moved to Brooklyn, where he started a new business and worked part-time as a salesman for E.J. Brock & Sons, creators of the much-hated candy corn and conversation hearts. With a wife and two children to support, the part-time income was barely enough to get by, and selling candy during the Great Depression turned out to be pretty difficult. The second business folded in 1933. Undeterred, he started a third company, the Midwest Candy Company, which failed after 2 years. So Robert filed for bankruptcy and moved to Boston to work for his younger brother's candy company, the James O. Welch Company. He had taught his baby brother all he knew about the candy business, and now here he was working for him, which he would for the next 20 years. The brothers had been competitive with each other all their lives, but when it came to business, they were a dynamic duo. James had the business acumen, and Robert was a born salesman. Robert thrived in Boston, becoming not only the candy company's vice president in charge of advertising and sales, but also a director of the Boston Chamber of Commerce, a member of the Cambridge Chamber of Commerce, a national counselor of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, a member of the local school board, and the director of a bank. In 1941, Welch published his first of several books, The Road to Salesmanship. During World War II, he served on the War Production Board and became chairman of the National Confectioners Association's Washington Committee. He was appointed to the board of directors of the prestigious National Association of Manufacturers, which he held for 7 years. These various positions put him in the social circles of wealthy elites and business people, which would prove invaluable for the establishment and growth of the JBS. All the while, Robert's political ideology continued to solidify into a reactionary, anti-New Deal worldview. He was a firm believer in austerity, in entrepreneurial spirit and American individualism, and felt that New Deal policies stifled business. This didn't stop him from striking cynical deals with New Deal bureaucrats, gaining benefits for the James O. Welch Company. But he remained a staunch conservative and believed the progressive policies of FDR would bankrupt the country. He believed the elite intelligentsia was propagating communism and Marxism through the schools, film industry, newspapers and magazines, and every institution central to American life. He had no faith in small-d democracy. The U.S. was a republic, and giving the masses too much power over political life threatened the good of the populace. Robert became more connected with the conservative right as a member of the America First Committee. Opposition to the New Deal and American entrance into World War II united him with other right-wing thinkers, particularly those with more Midwest attitudes toward the Eastern establishment. According to Edward Miller, this was in part due to Welch having different cultural and business ties than Eastern manufacturers, as he relied on dairy farmers in the Midwest and sugar growers in the South. Regional cultures clashed, with the Midwest resenting the wealthy East as, in Miller's words, arrogant, exploitative, abusive, and most ominously, Anglophilic. Welch's sympathies laid not with national corporations or large financial institutions, but with small business owners and farmers. On behalf of self-employed dentists, he opposed fluoridation of the water. After all, those children's cavities are good business. On behalf of doctors, he opposed universal health care. Those aches and pains are highly profitable. Robert devoured the work of Ludwig von Mises and Friedrich Hayek and supported an Asia First policy which would focus American resources on the Far East to stop the encroachment of Chinese communism. With regards to Europe, he was an isolationist, believing World War I to be a waste of American resources and the cause of the Bolsheviks' rise to power. The war hadn't made the world safe for democracy, it had made it safe for communists. He favored high tariffs, low taxes, and he absolutely hated the League of Nations, later the United Nations, for the threat they posed to American sovereignty. America Firsters feared that entry into World War II would bring socialism to the land, and that Hitler was no great threat to the all-important American economy. Though not an outspoken anti-Semite himself, he kept the company of brazen anti-Semites and revered Charles Lindbergh even after his infamous Des Moines, Iowa speech in which he called Jews the greatest danger to this country thanks to their large ownership and influence in our motion pictures, our press, our radio, and our government. As best we know, Welch never repeated such sentiments himself, and he maintained friendly business ties with many in the Jewish community. But substitute Jews for communists, and it was something Welch himself had said and would continue to say for many years. AFC member Clarence Mannion was very influential for Robert. A Catholic from Kentucky, Mannion would be a lifelong friend to Welch and a prominent member of the John Birch Society. He feared that another European war would bring a European brand of democracy to the United States. Furthermore, the war was a means for communists who had infiltrated the government to grow the size of the state in preparation for a dictator to take power. World War II caused Welch's belief in conspiracy theories to grow. He claimed that the clamps are already being put on the free speech of those who disagree with the warmongering policies of FDR's administration, and that immense subtle pressures were applied through 100 devious channels to quiet those who would speak out. Entry into World War II would only strengthen the Soviets, and he and Mannion agreed that Hitler and Stalin should be left to duke it out on their own. In the decades to come, Welch would blame America's intervention in the war for myriad problems. But America Firsters had a dilemma. They couldn't seem to escape accusations of being pro-fascist. It didn't help that Father Coughlin's Christian Front and the German-American Bund, both pro-Nazi organizations, also supported the AFC. The viciously anti-Semitic Protocols of the Elders of Zion and Henry Ford's Dearborn Independent circulated widely in AFC circles. Despite their differences on the question of Jews, after Pearl Harbor, one thing was largely agreed upon. It had been an inside job. Roosevelt had engineered the whole thing as a backdoor to war. He had staged a silent coup. At the very least, Welch and others thought, America should pursue a Pacific First policy in the war. After all, it had been Japan that attacked Pearl Harbor. But as American involvement in Europe seemed to take precedent, Roberts' conspiracism only grew. Welch's first foray into electoral politics was working for the 1946 campaign of Republican Robert Bradford. He won the election for governor of Massachusetts, and Robert now had the itch. He became vice chairman of the Massachusetts Republican Finance Committee. Welch's first political speech was before the League of Women Voters in January 1946. A left-wing speaker had recently appeared before the club, and given their policy of airing opposing sides, Robert thought he ought to have a shot. He wrote the women a letter of dissent, gave a $50 donation, and asked, "It's just too bad that you don't have someone to present the other side. Why don't you?" So he was invited to speak at the next meeting. The topic, should price controls and wartime rationing continue now that the war was over? His opinion was obviously no. But while his left-wing opponent had been given a full hour before the League, Robert was given only 15 minutes. It reeked of conspiracy. Letters poured in about his unfair treatment, and it all ended up benefiting Welch in the end. He was inundated with requests to speak before other service organizations like Chambers of Commerce and Rotary Clubs. In his speeches, Robert made it clear that the conspiracy was not the lone cause of creeping collectivism. Cycles of history ultimately resulted in degeneration at one point or another. The Babylonians, the Assyrians, the Romans had all fallen prey to big government. He claimed, "Contrary to popular belief, price control is not a grand new idea invented yesterday. There is nothing new about it at all. 3,900 years ago, in about 2000 BC, when the old Babylonian Empire had reached its apex and was starting its process of disintegration, Hammurabi invoked a hard and fast price control as one of his measures to try to stave off chaos." He continued, "2,500 years ago, in the 6th century BC, when the Assyrian Empire had gone to pieces, Nineveh itself was destroyed, and the remnants were being held together in a false burst of final glory that had become known as the Neo-Babylonian Empire, Nebuchadnezzar used price control to bring stability to the society. And 1,600 years ago, in the last decade of the 3rd century AD, the Roman Emperor Diocletian, facing the problems of economic decay, substituted a managed economy for law of supply and demand. He distributed food to the poor at half the market price. Don't think our food stamps are anything new. Undertook extensive public works to busy the unemployed, and inaugurated a complete new deal." For Welch, Diocletian was just one more emperor holding on to power and trying in vain to stitch together a dying civilization. I don't know enough about the Babylonians and Assyrians and Romans to argue with Welch, but whatever else the truth is, you can't say he wasn't a student of history. Now, Europe was falling prey to the same natural processes, but America was different. It was still young and vibrant. Collectivism and big government in the United States was out of tune with the cycles of history. The reason for this rupture of the natural processes of rise and decline of civilizations? A global cabal trying to destroy the republic. His economic arguments were straight out of libertarian thinkers like Hayek and von Mises, and he especially loved Hayek's The Road to Serfdom. More government meant less freedom. And yet, he wasn't a radical libertarian himself. He believed there was a role for government, specifically protection from threats to private property and individual freedoms. At times, he seemed to express support for an enlightened monarchy, even. In 1946, he argued, "I am convinced America would be better off with a government of 300,000 officials and agents, every single one of them a thief, than a government of 3 million agents with every single one of them an honest, honorable public servant. For the first group would only steal from the American economic system. The second group would be bound in time to destroy it." That year, he traveled to Britain to study what he believed to be the socialist takeover of the government. This, he declared in speeches, was what America would look like in a decade. It was bleak. He called the region stark and unadorned, and argued that the standard of living had plummeted thanks to the implementation of socialist policies. His audiences nodded along and clapped, and then went back to their day-to-day lives. It wasn't enough for Robert. He wasn't having an impact. The time had come to enter politics properly. Though he admitted that he had no desire to serve in office and did not even think he had the talent to do so, he proclaimed, "I can't take what is happening any longer." See, Robert had a sense that Americans were tired of the New Deal. Robert Taft was his hero. Further, he and other writers were convincing their readers that the highest levels of government had been infiltrated by traitors. Dean Acheson, George Marshall, and even President Eisenhower himself were enemies of the state, and perhaps outright communists. When the Red Spy Queen, Elizabeth Bentley, told the House Un-American Activities Committee in 1948 that a powerful communist cell was operating within the government, implicating nearly 150 government agents, with no documentary evidence, mind you, she went unpunished. Combined with the Alger Hiss espionage case, the activities of the HUAC, and Joseph McCarthy's list of 205 communists working in the State Department, the second Red Scare further fueled Robert's suspicions and encouraged him to enter politics. Both Massachusetts Senate seats and his House of Representatives Congresswoman were all popular Republicans, so Congress was out of reach for Welch, a disappointment given his penchant for foreign policy issues. He settled on the Massachusetts Lieutenant Governor's race in 1949. He ran on reducing government overreach and the creeping collectivism of the New Deal. He told Christian Science Monitor, "Our first and most important job is to keep us from going any further than we have already gone in extension of government ownership of business, operation of business, interference with business, control of business, and control of the details of our daily life." He opposed socialized healthcare, federal housing programs, and federal aid to education. But Welch didn't excel in the ways of a backslapping, charismatic politician. He was painfully introverted. He stumbled through speeches, dropping his papers on the floor and hacking up half a lung thanks to his love of cigars. He rambled on, reading from typed speeches with long, awkward pauses, appearing distant, unable to connect with an audience. He fidgeted, took his glasses off and put them back on again over and over. Welch had a disposition for writing, not speaking. He favored books over people, exceedingly proud of his 5,000-book library. In his book, The World of the John Birch Society, Conspiracy, Conservatism, and the Cold War, author D.J. Malloy describes Welch's early political articulations as having a tendency toward melodramatic, if not apocalyptic, rhetoric and a firm belief in the revelatory power of the conspiratorial. You can see what Malloy calls the embryonic form of this disposition in a fundraising letter from July of 1950, in which Welch wrote, "The strategy of the socialists is to divide and conquer, call all businessmen crooks so that nobody will speak up for them, and strangle them with controls and taxation, bribe all the farmers with their own money into a selfish pressure group for more bribes, infiltrate labor unions and convert them into political tools, discredit the medical profession until the rest of the public clamors for government medicine, attack every segment of our population with tactics which alienate the support of all other segments. The forces on the socialist side amount to a vast conspiracy to change our political and economic system." How very Jeffersonian. According to his biographer, G. Edward Griffin, this was the first instance of Welch using the word conspiracy in a public address. Edward Miller accuses him of sophistry and gilding the lily in his speeches and writings, though he was pretty good at self-promotion. Robert argued that Massachusetts was a guinea pig for socialist programs, duplicating the English practices that had transformed that country. He railed against the Fabian Society and socialized medicine, declaring that private entities ran everything better than any public institution could. What was needed was a dissolution of the welfare state, deep tax cuts, and better cooperation between management and those pesky labor unions. Welch came in second, losing by over 100,000 votes. But it was a remarkable campaign for a first-time candidate. The fact was that Robert was too reactionary for Massachusetts. He was also not a veteran at a time when that was very important in American politics. Railing against American involvement in World War II, which was considered a moral and just war, was not popular. Nonetheless, Republicans did well nationally, and Welch seemed to be poised to run for office again in 1952. The first meeting of the Welch Campaign Committee was held at the Brockton City Republican Committee headquarters in March of 1951. What was he running for? It didn't seem to matter to the 75 people in attendance. The plan was to begin by establishing small chapters throughout Massachusetts that would work toward advancing the principles of small government and Americanism. They wouldn't just talk, they would act. And so, a prototype of what would eventually become the John Birch Society was born. Thanks for listening to this episode of Reaction. If you like the show, please rate and review it. And consider supporting my work by visiting patreon.com/reactionpodcast. There, you can find all the episode scripts, as well as bonus audio content that supplements the main episodes. Follow the show on Twitter @ReactionPodcast for episode updates, and send your questions or feedback to reactionpod@gmail.com. This show is written and produced by me, Brittany Gill. Until next time.